Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson with the Local Government Report.
We're here as the watchdogs for your local government agencies, telling you what your elected officials have been up to in the last week and what's coming up on their agendas in the coming week.
For instance, county supervisors postponed a hearing on a renewable energy work plan for our region until September 25th. The agenda includes discussion of a community choice aggregation power company. In other words, creating an alternative to SDG&E for consumers to buy power. The county government has been buying 90% of its power from sources other than SDG&E in recent years, saving millions of dollars. Now they will decide whether consumers shall have the same price break.
Supervisors approved this week a new equine ordinance that will make it easier for property owners to stable horses without a major use permit except for very large operations. A last-minute amendment by Supervisor Diane Jacob will allow even smaller property owners in rural areas to offer riding lessons. Now, most speakers voiced support, but some raised concern over impacts on neighbors, with up to 10 horses per usable acre now allowed without a major use permit. The vote drew applause, however, from happy horse owners in the audience without a single nay vote.
La Mesa City Council voted to take away funding from a consultant on the controversial Planning Business Development District, or PBID, after hearing a proposal for a dramatically scaled-down version. Councilman Ernie Ewan told East County Magazine that the PBID proposal put too much control into the hands of few large property owners. The PBID originally aimed to market the downtown business district and provide funds for maintenance, but some landowners said that they could not afford the fees. So the prospect of a PBID in La Mesa's future now seems dim.
The California Public Utilities Commission is asking the court to levy a $1 million fine and approve a receiver to take over the troubled Live Oak Springs Water Company, a public water district with a history of health violations, alleged water test tampering, and fines for illegal water sales to developers. The owner has asked for a rehearing and accused the CPUC legal team of malicious wrongdoing. In response, a CPUC attorney accused Live Oak Springs owners of, quote, throwing spaghetti against the wall to see if they can get anything to stick. Instead, he said, all they've managed to do is make a big mess, which others are obligated to clean up.
The San Diego City Council will hold a hearing on the proposed Castle Rock housing development bordering Santee on Monday, September 16th at 2 p.m. In July, the city's planning commission voted for a plan to annex the property to the city of Santee. Now the environmental group Preserve Wild Santee has raised questions over donations made by 12 Party Homes employees to Council President Pro Tem Sherry Leitner. Environmentalists say the project would have negative impact on the environment, waterways, wildlife habitat, including destruction of vernal pools, home to endangered fairy shrimp. Supporters say the project would create needed housing and construction jobs. The project could include up to 430 residential units on 204 acres near the Santee-San Diego border. Concerns have also been raised that the city of Santee could incur costs for emergency services to the new community and should therefore receive property tax revenues generated by the project if built.
Now, down in the Jamul area, the Jamul-Dulzura Community Planning Group has received a notice of preparation regarding a draft environmental impact report for roadway improvements to Highway 94. These would include widening of the highway to provide access to the Jamul Indian Reservation, where a casino is proposed, as well as improvements to intersections of Highway 94 and Hamishaw Boulevard, Hamishaw Road, Steel Canyon Road, Lyons Valley Road, and Maxfield Road. Many accidents have occurred on this roadway, and residents have long voiced concerns about inadequate evacuation routes on Highway 94 during fires. But now some fear the highway widening proposal is paving the way for approval of a casino proposed at the Hummel Indian Village, where despite substantially scaled back plans by the tribe, the project still faces broad community opposition. A meeting is planned on the matter for September 17th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Cottonwood Golf.
You can find details on these and other hot issues in our local communities at our website, www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery, and today I'm here with Van Collinsworth, who is the director of Preserve Wild Santee. Van, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Miriam. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, he's here to tell us a bit about the Castle Rock housing development by Pardee Homes, which is coming up for a vote before the San Diego City Council on Monday. Can you give us some details about when and where that hearing will be held?
Yeah, that's going to be in San Diego City Council, 202 C Street, 12th floor. It's going to be 2 p.m. It's going to be item 202. So we encourage everybody to get there, get a speaker slip in. If you can't get there and get a speaker slip in, at least get an opposition registered with the San Diego City Council.
Or I should say whatever your point of view is. The project itself, if fully built out as proposed, would be up to 430 residential units on 204 acres. And this is very near the Santee-San Diego border. And there's been some talk about plans to possibly annex the property. Now, Van, can you clarify, is this a vote on the annexation to the city of Santee, or is this a vote on approving the entire project?
San Diego's action is the first action, and they will pick from one of the two scenarios. They could do annexation to Santee, or suggest that, or they could approve it as part of San Diego. Now, it's a complicated project and approval process, but San Diego is the key this Monday.
And the reason the city wants to annex it is, I understand, they're concerned about having to provide the fire and emergency medical services, police, and so forth, and not getting the property tax revenues.
Well, just to be clear, San Diego would de-annex it, and then Santee would consider whether or not to annex it. From our perspective, Preserve Wild Santee's perspective, this is a very flawed project. When you look at it from the start, it's already four times as many housing units as allowed by the zoning.
Four times?
Four
times.
Does
that mean they would need to get a variance for this to be approved?
Yes, there's a lot of different approvals that are mixed in here. But yes, they would need to change the zoning.
Now tell us what your greatest concerns are if this project is built.
Well, right away, when you look at four times the number of housing units that are allowed, you're multiplying the impacts in all these other areas, whether it's traffic, public safety, water, environmental resources. So basically, you know, if we're going to take land that the highest and best use really is as an addition to Mission Trails Park and sacrifice it for housing, then we need to do it right in a sustainable way. This project doesn't even have solar. So that's the first place we could start, is to make sure that the housing units themselves are at least address the increasing energy demand and your increasing energy bills and get solar PV.
There are also some serious traffic concerns, I understand. This could entail an extension of Mast Boulevard. Is that correct?
Well, that would not be part of the project in terms of the extension, but there would be a huge impact to Mast Boulevard, which is already congested, and it's difficult to get on Highway 52. And, of course, there's an expansion of the landfill with increasing truck traffic that will be coming as well.
But it would certainly increase pressures to expand Mast Boulevard, which is a controversial proposal.
Well, it could increase the pressure to connect to Lakeside, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, though, with this project is it's located in a state-identified very high fire severity zone. And so all of those homes, the only way to evacuate them is out onto Mast Boulevard, which is already congested.
And we all remember the Cedar Fire that ripped through that area, well, I would say like wildfire, but just lickety-split through there overnight. So that's a rather terrifying thought.
Yes, and they're creating new wildland urban interfaces that are exposed to those northeast Santa Ana wind-driven fires.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, if you get people that are stuck in their vehicles and exposed to radiant heat, they die. So this is a serious issue that needs to be...
Has anything been done to address this issue, Van, and protect people if that should happen?
In my opinion, no. There is a fire protection plan that's a part of the project. It's inadequate from our perspective. It doesn't look at the issues of shelter in place or evacuation, when and under what scenarios they would do so. It doesn't look at whether or not Mass Boulevard is going to be gridlocked when a Santa Ana wind-driven fire comes through. So there's huge issues in terms of locating that many people with limited opportunity to evacuate.
What about water quality issues?
Water quality is a huge issue. You know, already in Santee, we have the highest water rates. In San Diego, we pretty much have the highest water rates in the state. But when you look at our water statewide, places like Humboldt County, which have, you know, always been, I mean, six rivers, huge amounts of water, they're stealing water right now because they're under the drought conditions. So water is a huge issue. We can't just expect that because there's a tap, we're going to be able to turn it on and have water there.
Yeah. And there's also concerns raised about the last remaining vernal pools that have endangered fairy shrimp, I understand.
Yes, there's four pools there that have endangered San Diego fairy shrimp. All four of those will be graded. They are going to try to restore some pools that don't have fairy shrimp, but even those pools are located within 21 to 48 feet of the new subdivision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you go out camping and get a wilderness permit, they tell you to stay at least 100 feet away from it. So you can imagine over time what locating over 400 homes is going to do to these supposedly restored vernal pools. They're not going to make it. And I was a former wildland firefighter. And when we need to defend fire there, the first thing we're interested in doing is putting the fire out. So if we got to take a bulldozer through fight fire in that area to defend property and
bye-bye
and lives, yeah, the resources take a back seat to that.
Yeah, we've seen that over and over. Now, in all fairness, the other side is not here today. But what they would argue if they were here, I think, would be that the project will create needed housing and jobs for the community. What would your response be to that?
Well, there's just better ways to do it. And in terms of this project itself, if they were to do a better project that looked at the resources, respected the land, respected the zoning to a greater extent, it's possible that we may be able to come up with a project that could suit the site because there is about 100 acres there that's
available. Yeah, so you're not opposed to any development there, just something that's smaller in scale and more respectful of environmental needs and fire concerns.
Correct. And unfortunately, this project doesn't do it. So the San Diego City Council really needs to send this back to the drawing board so that Pardee and Weyerhaeuser can get serious about doing a sustainable project that's beneficial to the public.
Well, very good. And again, for those that tuned in late, the hearing on the Castle Rock project will be held Monday at 2 o'clock at the San Diego City Council. Ben, thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Thank you, Mary. It was my pleasure.
Coming up next, the Chaldean Corner on East County Magazine's radio show, bringing you news for and about our region's Iraqi Chaldean community. This is Miriam Raftery, and today I'm very honored to be here with Dr. Nuri Barka, who is the head of the Chaldean American Institute, and he is also the organizer of this Saturday's Chaldean Festival in El Cajon. Nuri, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the festival this weekend, how it got started, and what it's all about.
Yeah, actually, over time, with the increasing number of our people, the Chaldean people in El Cajon City mainly, we have reached over 50,000 Chaldean in the East County. And we decided to start this festival like 4 years ago to introduce our community, our culture, our history to our American citizen. So we started that 4 years ago in El Cajon downtown in the Promenade Park. Then we did second one on the at YMCA in Rancho, and the third one was done on the Promenade again, and the fourth one is going to be tomorrow, which is going to be in the downtown El Cajon area also, but by the Sentinel area, which is by the court, the El Cajon court or El Cajon City Hall.
Mm-hmm. And what time will the festival be running on Saturday?
The Saturday start at 4 p.m. from 4 to 10 p.m. and on Sunday will be from 1 to 10 p.m.
Now, I understand that in addition to trying out all those great Middle Eastern foods and Chaldean foods, there's a lot of music and games. Tell us about some of the
entertainment. We have this year actually increased the number of performance. We brought a very famous group of singers from Michigan, and we end up having 19 singers performing tomorrow and Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And beside, you know, the our music, our food, our activity, we have a lot of games for children and adults. And it's all free admission. Mm-hmm. So we'd like to get all our citizens to come and have fun with their family to join us at this fourth Chaldean Festival.
It's a very joyous occasion. I've been there before, and they have people from the audience out doing line dancing and learning the traditional dances. So it's really a very exciting atmosphere, something that's very family-oriented. Tell us, for those readers who may not know who the Chaldeans are or about their history, these are people from Iraq. They are Chaldean Christians, descended from early Christianity. Mm-hmm. Nuri, tell us a little bit more about their rich culture and heritage.
The history of Chaldean goes back deep in the history, and actually Iraq, or it used to be called the Mesopotamia, is the origin of these people. And basically Chaldean are native Iraqi people. They are the original people of Iraq. And if you read in the history, in the Babylonian time, and they were the first to discover the wheel. They were the first to discover the number zero. They were the first writing and the first language. All these good things happened during that time with the Chaldean people, the first law in the world. Mm-hmm. And also, if you know about the harp of Ur, this is the first instrument known to human being, was discovered in Ur of Chaldea, which is now present in the British Museum in London.
So the first laws, the first writings, many, many great things. We really all have a great debt, I think, to the Chaldean people, or the descendants of today's Chaldeans who are here in El Cajon. Now, a few years ago, there were only a handful of Chaldeans mm-hmm. in our area. And yes. then the war has brought many more refugees. So today there's some 50,000 or so of them in the San Diego region, mostly East County. How are they doing, Nuri? And is there help out there that's needed for these folks?
Yeah, actually, after the invasion of Iraq 2003, and with the number of attacks against our people, over 70 churches were destroyed, and thousands of Chaldean or Christian in general were killed.
And they were persecuted.
They were persecuted by fanatic Muslim in general, mm-hmm. Because we are considered pro-Western. When they look at us, we believe in a Western value. We believe in a human right value. So these fanatic Muslim, they were like, we were an easy target for them because we are peaceful segment of the community. We don't carry weapon. We don't have any militia mm-hmm. to fight for us. So we were an easy target for these groups, and we were attacked in many different way, and many of our bishops and priests were killed during this time. So people start leaving Iraq to neighboring country like Syria, Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon, and thousands. So we lost over 70% of our people that were surviving in Iraq for thousands of years. Wow. We lost them over the last 10 years. Now they are all over the world, and we get a significant segment of these people in San Diego now, and in El Cajon especially, because they want to be close to the church. And that's the reason you see a big number of them living in El Cajon area, and because our main church in El Cajon.
Yes, and they're certainly contributing a great deal to the local economy. We're seeing many new storefronts opening mm-hmm. up on Main Street in El Cajon that are owned by Chaldean immigrants. Mm-hmm. How are they doing overall? I can't imagine coming to a foreign country with nothing but the clothes on yeah. your back, maybe, yeah. you know, running from a war situation.
You can say we have two groups, the old comers that were here before the war, before the 2003. We used to have 5,000 families. They are very established. 5,000 family, they own 1,000 businesses in San Diego, which is very significant, like 20%, which is very unique if you look at it in a statistic way. The newcomer are more like they came over the last, like, say, 10 years, and they are still suffering because, you know, the economy is not that great in our mm-hmm. country. And also, they came, they left everything behind. They left because for the safety of their family and their mm-hmm. children. So there is a different story for this group, and somehow they are suffering now because of the limitation we have and resources that are available for them. But they are getting their way, and with the help of our community, I mean, and with the help of the school system we have. So there is room for them to get education and find jobs. And that's something they lack. I mean, the unemployment rate in our community with this group is over 35-40%.
35-40% unemployment. Mm-hmm. Wow. So jobs is really the biggest need, in this community. Well, Nuri, it sounds like an amazing activity this weekend. Is there anything else that you would like readers to know? Where can they get more information about the Chaldean Festival?
Actually, they can look at the website. We have a website called caldaya.net that have all the information on the festival and the singer and the music and the food. caldaya.net.
Very good. And there's also some information posted at our site, eastcountymagazine.org. And it sounds like a great opportunity for the entire community to come out, meet your new Chaldean neighbors, and have a good time celebrating in East County.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Next up, Aria Johansson will join us with Destination East County, telling you about even more community events this weekend.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. It's the 24th annual Sequan Powwow this weekend, starting Friday, September 13th, and continuing all weekend through Sunday, September 15th in El Cajon. The Sequan Band of the Kumeyaay Nation hosts this cultural event, which includes competitions for all ages in categories such as gourd dancing, bird singing and bird dancing, drum and singing, hand drum, peon games, and chicken dance. There will be a flag ceremony, as well as food and arts and crafts vendors. Originally a powwow, or celebration, was held in the spring to welcome the beginnings of life. It was a time for people to get together, sing, dance, renew old friendships, and make new ones, and a time for young people to meet and court. At that time, families could hold naming and honoring ceremonies. The Sequan Powwow begins at dusk on Friday evening at 7 p.m., and then at 1 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. The Lemon Grove Historical Society hosts its Hawaiian Luau on Saturday, September 14th, from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. This event will be held under the stars and twinkling lights of the gazebo courtyard at the historical H. Lee House in Lemon Grove. The festivities will include island music, feasting, hula dancing, and the dramatic spectacle of the Polynesian fire dance. Also on Saturday, September 14th, there will be a wine and cheese friendraiser in Alpine from 6 to 9 p.m. The Alpine community and the Backcountry Land Trust invite guests to an evening at Wright's Field Preserve. Celebrating this beautiful open space preserve in the heart of Alpine, the event benefits land conservation, watershed stewardship, and environmental education in East County. There will be live old-time country music by the Podunk Poets, hors d'oeuvres, fruit and dessert plates, and a hosted bar will be available. As an added feature, if you like, you can hike to the event in 5 minutes after parking at the Joan McQueen Middle School on Tavern Road. Also in Alpine, the Sage and Songbirds 3rd Annual Festival will be held Sunday, September 15th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Alpine Creek Town Center. The event celebrates Alpine's designation as America's first community wildlife habitat by the National Wildlife Federation. Free events and activities include crafts for kids, butterfly education, live birds of prey, live hummingbirds, snakes, reptiles, bugs, and other critters, arts and crafts vendors, a garden mart and plant sale, and live entertainment. There will be a butterfly release at 2 p.m. The town of Acumba Hot Springs is gearing up for its centennial celebration, planned for next year in 2014. 4 major festivals are planned for the centennial: a 3rd Annual Blues Festival, May 3rd, a Healing Waters and Arts Festival the weekend of May 24th, a Centennial Fall Festival on October 4th, and a Christmas Festival December 6th. More details on these festivals will be announced at a later date. Shelby and Teague perform on Saturday, September 14th at 2 p.m. at the Poway branch of the San Diego County Library System. The performers are a singing-songwriting folk duo reminiscent of Simon and Garfunkel. The fall series of the San Diego County Library Acoustic Showcase offers a variety of San Diego's best singer-songwriters, folk music performers, and storytellers the concerts are free to the community. An upcoming event to preview takes place at Mission Trails Regional Park on Saturday evening, October 5th. This event is the second annual Mission Trail Regional Park Foundation's Art in the Park and does require tickets. Featured art from over 45 award-winning artists will be on display and for sale, with over 100 pieces of nature-related art in a variety of painting styles, ceramics, photography, and sculpture. CBS 8 meteorologist and lifestyle reporter Sean Stiles and Mission Publishing Group's publisher Jim Madaffer return as honorary co-chairs for this event in the Visitor Center from 6 to 9 p.m. There will be a silent and a live auction ready for your bidding. This is an evening of fine art, fine wine, fine cheese, and fine chocolate. Entertainment will be provided by the members of the San Diego Native American Flute Circle, followed by the Caprice Strings Trio. The San Diego Astronomy Association will have telescopes on the terrace for viewing the stars. All of these events and more can be found on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at www.eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County!
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
In the good old summertime, in the good old summertime, strolling through the shady lane with your baby mine. You hold her hand and she holds yours, and that's a very good sign that she's your tootsie wootsie in the good old summertime.
This is a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. As temperatures climb, it's important to stay cool. Seniors and those without air conditioning are particularly vulnerable to heat-related illness. The county has provided a list of cool zones where you can beat the heat, including places in East County, such as libraries and senior centers. All are free and open to the public during designated hours. You can find a list of school zones in your area at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery, and my newsmaker today is Eldonna Lay with the El Cajon Historical Society. She is the past president of the organization and the curator of the Knox House Museum. She's also the author of a special two-part book series, Valley of Opportunity, about El Cajon's colorful history, published in the city's centennial year. Eldonna, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here.
Now, the city is in the midst of celebrating its centennial, but of course its history dates back much farther than that. Eldonna, can you tell us about some of the area's earliest inhabitants?
The first inhabitants, of course, were the ancestors of our current Indian tribes, the Kumeyaay Nation, the Saquons, all of whom are still making news and exciting news of events and recent purchases or acquisitions of lands that in the paper they mention are going to be kept as wild lands. Most impressive. So they inhabited the place first and crisscrossed the El Cajon Valley on their way from the mountains to the ocean.
And that goes back many thousands of years.
Yes. They're saying 12,000, but there are those anthropologists who, and archaeologists who say that it could be closer to 15.
And that would be older than most any of the ancient civilizations, the ancient Romans, Egyptians. Who were the first non-Native Americans to come to our region, and what brought them here, Aldana?
The first that we know of now, as a historian, I have to say, we never know everything. Sometimes we think we do, but we don't. The first that we know about were the Chinese, actually.
Really?
Who came in the 16th century. Murray Lee has written of that. He is affiliated with the Chinese Museum downtown. And so they have found remains of the boats and the things that were in those boats that the Chinese brought here. And they went on down into Mexico and Central America and South America. And they're discovering more all the time.
Were they in El Cajon?
We don't know yet because we haven't looked for it yet. We don't know how far inland they came down here.
But then the Spanish came along.
The explorers and made maps of the area, the first maps of the area. Then they were followed in the 1800s by American explorers.
But before the Americans, you had the Spanish priests who had some interesting uses for the El Cajon Valley. Tell us about that.
When they had started their agricultural work in the valley, they also started looking around into the other valleys and the highlands to see what they could grow there. And in El Cajon, the valley, they planted grapes, which was the first vineyards in the area that were commercially grown. There were wild grapes.
And those grapes were grown for the sacramental wines served in church.
Yes, indeed.
Now, there was also a lot of mining going on. That's a little known but very colorful corner of El Cajon's history. But I understand that after gold was discovered in Julian, the rush was on and they were looking for it everywhere. Tell us how that impacted El Cajon.
It had a huge impact, mainly because there had been so many other gold and silver strikes throughout the world. So it became a little safer if it was here on the American soil. And so they came in by boat, most of them by ship.
They went around Cape Horn by clipper ship. That is quite a journey. You'd have to really want to come to California to go through all of that.
Absolutely. It was a rough trip. Some people walked across or rode across the peninsula in Panama.
Mm-hmm.
But this was before 1915.
No canal yet.
Which, incidentally, we will be celebrating next year in Balboa Park, because Balboa Park was built to celebrate the building of the Panama Canal.
Fascinating.
It's going to be a huge celebration.
So they found gold in El Cajon. Give us a general idea of where that was and how successful were those ventures.
They were very successful, and some of those gold mines remain here. There
really?
Are belts of them. Upper Chase Avenue had a number of them, one large enough to have cars and tracks going into them. But during the 30s and early 40s, Franklin Delano Roosevelt took us off the gold standard, and that depleted the demand for gold at that time. So they closed the mines.
Now, how did the gold mines impact the community of El Cajon? That must have been quite a boost for the economy.
I honestly don't know about the boost, because a lot of outsiders came in to work on this, too.
Mm-hmm.
There was one family, the Parsons family, and they're still in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, my husband and I purchased some of their property, and we have the entry to one of the gold mines on our property.
So you're living on a gold mine. How fascinating.
The funny part of that is my husband's from Helena, Montana, and his house there was built on top of one of the original gold mines.
Interesting.
Yes. So
now,
that's
not the only thing in El Cajon sitting on a gold mine. You've told me that one of the elementary schools, Fuerte Elementary School, is also on top of a gold mine. Is that true?
That's my gold mine. They're on top of.
Oh, okay. All right.
And there are a couple of stories about that. Number one, the gold mine is still there. The tunnels run under the septic tank of the school, which makes it a little unappealing.
You would think, with all the school funding crisis, maybe they want to do some drilling there.
Well, it's a thought. However, when they were scraping out the lower playground, the man running the skip loader at the time ran into a tunnel that was still stuffed with dynamite. and he was not badly hurt, but he ended up being the absolute first patient to arrive at the emergency room in the brand new Grossmont Hospital.
My goodness, that's amazing. You've told me that people came from around the world. A lot of people talk about the boom in immigration going on in El Cajon today in East County, but it didn't just start yesterday. Tell us a little bit about who some of the folks were that were coming here.
There was advertisement in Europe about El Cajon and La Mesa and some of the other communities. We were looking to claim America as our own, I should say the government was, and so they were encouraging pioneering and settlement. And what's most important, I think, is that El Cajon was settled after the Civil War. It makes all of the difference in the world because everything changed after that. Mm-hmm. So we did have some Southern families who came by the Southern route. It was opened again after the Civil War.
1870s?
1865 and after.
Civil War.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so Campo was settled. And we didn't have a formal border with Mexico at the time. Mm-hmm. So we had American families living down in what is now Mexico. They had huge ranches. So that's kind of a Southern settlement. The people coming by ship, of course, came from different places. A lot of New Englanders came here.
Now, what was behind the move to incorporate and actually become a city 100 years ago?
Well, that was 1912. And there were financial reasons, and also it gave settlers, and the people who came here were settlers, not pioneers. It's important to remember that people who go somewhere and they're not sure where they're going or what they're going to find because there aren't maps yet, those are pioneers. People knew about San Diego and later El Cajon, because people have been coming to San Diego since it was owned by Mexico.
So when they incorporated, one of the first things they did was outlaw a lot of the things those fun-loving miners had been enjoying and ranchers out there. Tell us a little bit about some of the first acts of the very first El Cajon Council.
Well, the first thing they did, I understand, was to stop horse racing on Main Street.
So our racing history didn't start with Del Mar, folks.
We were getting a little too elegant to have that sort of thing going on. Later on, there was a huge hullabaloo over the number of saloons that were there, and they were drawing people who came deliberately to get drunk, and they were causing a lot of trouble.
And what goes around comes around. El Cajon just recently enacted an ordinance cracking down on alcohol sales. It's amazing how these issues echo the issues of the past.
Yes, it is.
Now, I understand there were also some early ordinances addressing pigs and chickens. Tell us about that.
In the city, people had chickens. That didn't seem to be a problem right away. And I think recently that came up, too.
They outlawed it 100 years ago. And they just recently legalized backyard chicken owners or come out of the closet.
Talk about cycles, yes. And
what about the pigs?
Oh, the pigs. Pigs were grown out in Las Cochas. The Mission Padres had kept pigs there because it forms a natural basin. It was easy to keep them in. And so they would run pigs down Main Street, too, on the way to the slaughterhouses.
Pigs down Main Street.
Yes.
That's amazing. I didn't know that. Now, the first volume of your book, Valley of Opportunity, dealt with the city's first 75 years after incorporation. And your next book will deal with the last 25 years. When will that be out?
It'll be ready for Christmas.
What are some of the biggest changes that have occurred in El Cajon in the last 25 years?
El Cajon is a microcosm of, first, the United States, and then the rest of the world. And our whole world has changed in the last 25 years with the immediate ability to know what's going on and to watch it as it is happening. So we are influenced far more. And then when we began getting people from other countries here, we began taking them in as refugees, we had immediate reactions and settlement issues. The first group came in, I believe it was in the 80s when the boat people came in.
Vietnam.
And it was at that time 72 languages were being, or dialects, were being spoken in the schools. It was totally unexpected.
Huge challenge for the teachers.
Very, very challenging. I was with the school district at that time, and to see all of these adorable children coming in from all over, not knowing English, and the families discovering refrigerators for the first time, it was an acclimation that really, really challenged everybody, particularly because when they got here, they had been through terrible, terrible times. Many were badly traumatized.
And now we have many of the Iraqi refugees. I believe there's about 50,000 Iraqi Chaldeans alone living in the East County area, most of them right here in El Cajon.
Absolutely.
And Africans. I just interviewed someone today about how many more African refugees are winding up in El Cajon now.
And surrounding areas, Somalis, yes. And I think it's interesting, too, that you see that in the churches. We have an Egyptian church and a Syrian church and a Lebanese church. And they're all Christian churches, but they come from the original area where Christ was born and where Christianity began.
Now, how has the evolution of the aerospace industry had its impacts out here in El Cajon?
Well, a lot of the people who work there, my husband being an editor at General Dynamics, they lived out here. Also, in the industrial area, parts were made for the space vehicles, and other companies handle things for other kinds of vehicles.
What kind of growth have we seen in Gillespie Field in the last 25 years?
I'm not one to speak for them, but it is fascinating to go on their tours, to go out there for dinner and watch the action going on, partially at least because of East County Economic Development Council has been in the stage of growing, and I think there will be considerable more growth.
Now, what are some of the changes that are in the works right now for El Cajon? And if you want to look in your crystal ball a little bit, what are some of the things that you would like to see over the next 100 years?
One of the things I admire are places in San Diego that have been remade, taking advantage of the newcomers here. Little Italy, I think, is a perfect example of modern and old and new and experimental. It is such an exciting place architecturally, with glass buildings tucked in between and behind the old building. There's just an elegant charm and an energy that you get when you mix those things together.
Yes, they celebrate the heritage of these
people. Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're fortunate enough to have Iraqi restaurants and other kinds of restaurants in town because it really, really broadens the palate of people. The food is delicious, incidentally. It's marvelous to have those newcomers start sharing through their businesses
now,
with
speaking
us.
Speaking of restaurants down there, I understand some changes are in the works. One change that we've certainly seen in recent years in El Cajon is an evolution of the downtown. There was a time when it was very blighted. There were a lot of boarded-up buildings, the old Pussycat Theater, X-rated stuff down there, and I understand that the last vestige of that, the F Street Bookstore, has closed its doors. And what's going to happen now with that area down there?
Well, I have to tell you, I am very, very proud to have been on that original board of the CDC when it came in. And later, I was on the city's Design Review Commission. Mm-hmm. And we saw all of those plans coming in, and we got to vote on and suggest improvements so that it would fit into the community. And through all of that, Gabe Marujo, who owns Por Favor and the Downtown Cafe, has not slowed down one bit. He believes, and his sister, believe so much in downtown El Cajon that they have just purchased the F Street Bookstore and the store, the business across the street. I'm not sure what they're going to be doing there.
We're all looking forward to seeing what that is. It's kind of a big secret right now. We've also seen a lot of other storefronts down there change hands. Many of them by some of the immigrants, Iraqi immigrants. There's an Egyptian-owned store, at least one that's Mexican-owned, some others. So it really is a city of immigrants these days.
And it's an international thing that gives it a life and a sparkle that we didn't have before.
Can you foresee a day when we might see something like a New Babylonia or a New Babylon district that would be something that would draw tourists, sort of like San Francisco's Chinatown, or for that matter, the new Little Saigon Business District that just got its designation in San Diego along El Cajon Boulevard.
I think it would be marvelous to have that, because then we can celebrate the old, what we're used to, all the new things that America is turning out, and learn something about our foregoers in on another continent.
Fascinating. Now, I understand that there is a new multicultural festival of some sort in the works.
That is in the process, and the city is perfect to put it on. We've had good experiences in the past with international events, mm-hmm. so there's great promise and sparkle in that.
And without you losing the Western heritage and the Native American heritage, of course, have so long been a part of El Cajon's history and culture and its very colorful past.
And we have that with the Olaf Weekhorst Museum. If you like cowboy things, and I understand from an agent friend of mine that cowboy things are coming back on TV. There will be a number of programs.
More westerns.
And so the music and the plots may be a little bit different, modernized, but they will be on TV and hopefully radio. I would hate to see western music in its original form be lost.
Yes. For those not familiar with the Wiegetorst Museum, Wiegetorst was one of the premier Western artists of his day. His works hung in the White House and
the Vatican.
John Wayne owned them. He was quite renowned. It's quite a marvelous museum out there of not only his own works, but other Western artists right here in downtown El Cajon.
May I also say that his paintings were hung in the White House under four or five different presidents.
Mm-hmm. So he... Bipartisan support.
There we go.
Well, Eldonna, it's been a delight to have you on the show. I'm really looking forward to reading your new book when it comes out and hearing more about what's going to be happening the rest of the year for the centennial, just as soon as those plans are rolled out.
I'm looking forward to them, too. Nobody knows how it's going to end, so I'm looking forward to the excitement of that.
Now, if people want to come down and take a tour of the Knox House Museum, tell us just a little bit about the Knox House Museum and how people can get more information about that.
Knox House Museum is named after Amaziah Knox, and his picture is on the standards of the El Cajon sign, and a new, huge photograph of him, graphic, is on the outside of the museum, which is on the corner of Parks and Magnolia. It's the kind of gaudy 1800s kind of house that he built himself.
And what was his role in El Cajon's history?
He was the founder. He was the first one to build a commercial building in El Cajon, and it was for the miners who were headed for Julian. And so we figured that in those days you didn't have to have beds for travelers. They could sleep in their roll-ups. And so we figure about seven men could sleep in one of the three bedrooms that were in the
Knox
place.
Knox House Hotel at one time.
Exactly. It started out that way. And so the building has in it furnishings donated by settler families. And it shows what the settlers brought with them. Because they were an upper-middle-class group that settled El Cajon, the Bostonia group was socially a bit higher than that. And they had on Saturday nights their own clubhouse, the forerunner of the Bostonian ballroom. And they dressed formally in tuxedos, gowns. I remember one elderly gentleman describing how, because his fingers were so little, his mother had him button up her long elbow-length gloves to go to dinner and dance at the Bostonia ballroom.
Truly a different world.
Well, you know, people come here and they want to recreate the places they left. And that's what today's immigrants want, too. And so we are all a country of immigrants, and the changes that come through that make us all richer.
Those are very profound words. We're going to end there, and thank you very much, Eldonna, for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
I'm John Mattis, investigative guy, host of Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers, shining a light on shady deals all around us.
John Mattis has won seven Emmy Awards, a Golden Mike, and the Edward R. Murrow Award for exposing fraud and corruption.
Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers is produced by the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso.
John Mattis here with Investigative Guy, exposing all those scams. And wow, I've got some juicy ones today. Think about all those offers you get, those free dinners for financial planning, free dinners for living wills, free dinners for financial products. Well, here's a tip. Watch out. Watch out when you get those offers, because what they are offering is just for you to get scammed, for you to have your bank account lightened by con artists. What they love to do is get you into a room, offer you a free dinner, and then find out how many assets you really have, how many stocks you've got, what kind of portfolio you've got. And then what they're going to do is try to sell you a reverse mortgage or annuities or some kind of financial product. But their goal and their aim is to get control of your assets and to lighten your wallet, to take your money and put it into their pocket. So you've got to watch out. So whenever you get one of these free offers, there's one going around right now offering free dinners at Butcher Block to tell you about financial planning. My advice, run away. If you've got an elderly relative, tell them, don't let them go. It's dangerous, and all they're going to do is lose money at these schemes. These schemes have been going on for years, and all of the characters behind them, all of them have reputations, and all of them have records. So again, my advice, you get a free offer for a free dinner, walk away. It's dangerous, and they're going to sell you something that you didn't want, that you didn't need, and it's only going to make your financial portfolio shrink, shrink, shrink. Now, on to another scam that's really going on all over the county and all over the state. These online services that cold call small businesses and offer the small businesses help. Help, we're going to help your reputation online. We're going to help you with Yelp. We're going to help you get positive comments about your business. Well, guess what? Half of these are run by con artists. Over half of these have con men trying to get you, the small business owner, to sign up with their service so that you're paying them once a month with your credit card. Well, once they've got your credit card, look out. Now, what they're really doing is they're claiming to take down bad stuff about you on the internet. And what in reality, oftentimes they do, they plant negative things about you and then offer to take it down. It's not much different than a shakedown. But watch out. One of them here in San Diego, I'm not going to mention their name, that they're named actually Reputation Impression, is run by a man who's awaiting time to surrender to go to prison for another boiler room he ran. So would you give your money, if you're a small businessman, to someone who's awaiting time in jail? Of course you wouldn't. So you've got to watch out about these schemes. These schemes are going on. And if there's an offer out there to help you out with your, quote, reputation, be cautious. Ask questions. Ask who's really behind it. And then only give them a one-month check. Check them out. So bottom line today, you got to check out these offers. If it's too good to be true, it's going to be a scam. I'm John Mattis with Investigative Guy telling you, watch out. Thank you.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and KNSJ bringing you some special information as we enter fire season. How prepared are you for an emergency? Just as you change your smoke detector batteries whenever you change your clocks for daylight savings time, it's also a smart idea to check your emergency kit at the start of every fire season. That means now. Of course, emergencies such as an earthquake or a blackout can happen at any time with no advance warning. For households with children, elderly people, or those with limited mobility, being ready to take action is especially important. Updating your emergency list should start with a checklist. Did you add or lose any members of your household? Be sure to have enough supplies for everyone, including people and pets. Check the dates on canned goods and other perishables, and be sure that stored drinking water is still good. Create an emergency plan for your family.
Identify two places for the family to meet. One should be somewhere outside your home, but close by, perhaps a neighbor's or a street corner. The other should be a spot away from your neighborhood, just in case the entire area is evacuated and you can't return. Using information from SDG&E and supplementing it with some additional tips, we've come up with the following helpful suggestions to be prepared. Practice an evacuation plan with your family, including children. If they get used to doing something when there is no panic, they will be much less frantic should a real disaster strike. Review emergency plans at your workplace, your child's school or daycare center, friends' homes, and other places where members of your family regularly spend time. Plan safe routes away from your home and business to high, safe ground, and be sure all family members know the routes. Have alternative routes in mind if the first option is blocked. Develop a plan for family pets and livestock, and have a backup plan because some evacuation shelters may not allow animals. Designate a friend or family member outside the area who all family members can call if you become separated, and that way you can know if everyone is safe. Have family members memorize that phone number in case cell phones die and you can't access the phone directory. Keep current important documents in a safe deposit box or send copies outside the area to be kept by a trusted relative or friend. Be sure that you can access your insurance policy and have a copy of your deed, for example. After Hurricane Katrina, when banks were destroyed by flooding and hurricanes, many homeowners had a lot of trouble putting in their insurance claims. Have a set place for your emergency supplies. Your emergency kit should include, at minimum, a 3-day supply of bottled water, 1 gallon per person per day, plus extra for pets or anyone with special needs, a 3-day supply of packaged, dried, and canned food that can be prepared without cooking, a first aid kit, and essential medicines for all family members, a pet carrier for each pet and pet food, a manual can opener, a portable radio, plenty of batteries, and flashlights kept in waterproof bags, an extra set of car keys, credit cards, and always plenty of cash in case the power is out when ATM machines and credit card machines are not working. Special items for infants, elderly, or disabled family members. It's also important to make sure that you always keep plenty of gas in your car since pumps won't work when the power goes out. Also, be sure you have a car charger for your cell phones, since during a power outage, you don't want your cell phone to go dead. Car chargers are cheap, often less than $10, but can be crucial in an emergency. Know how to operate everything if the electricity is off, the keyless entry to your home, and an electric garage door and gates, for instance. Be sure you know how to open them manually. If you have a gas main, know how to shut it off in case of a leak or a disaster. Include instructions on how to shut off anything that's complicated in your family emergency kit. It's better to have supplies ready and never need them than to need them and not have them. SDG&E has also prepared some videos on fire season planning and general emergency preparedness that can be accessed in the Wildfire and Emergency section of our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.